Welcome to Life on the Illinois Prairie. Your host is Wendy Fleming Dexter, and after 30 years living in small town Illinois, she has stories to tell. Past cornfields and factories, into the heart of Amish country. There's more here than what meets the eye, far beyond what you think you know. So buckle up and stay tuned. This is Life on the Illinois Prairie.
Hi, and welcome to this episode of Life on the Illinois Prairie. I'm your host, Wendy Fleming Dexter. I have a returning guest joining me today, and I'm so glad to have him back. He's always a wealth of information and just an all-around good guy and good friend. I'd like to welcome back Chris Serdik, curator of the Mattoon History Center. Chris, thank you for coming back to the show.
Well, hi, Wendy. It's great to be back. I always enjoy these sessions.
I hope so, because I know I sure do. First off, I really want to, Stacy, and I want to offer you our sincere condolences on the loss of your son, Brian. I don't believe we've seen you since then, and I know that that's such a heartbreak, and I'm so, so sorry. But we just want to offer you our sincere sympathy.
Oh, well, thank you. It still resonates pretty deeply. It's one of those things that you just don't ever want to have to deal with. That's for sure.
Right. I know Stacy lost an adult daughter, so it's something that it's gut wrenching. But I just wanted to get that out of the way and tell you that. I don't want to ignore
that.
It. You know, it's a tough sure. thing. But we love you and just don't want to ignore it. But I want to get on to. Would you please give some background information about yourself and a little bit about your connection to the History Center? I mean, since you really are the History Center.
I guess I am. I was in the electrical supply business for almost 50 years. And when I retired, I was kind of just looking for something to do. I wanted to have I didn't want to just sit home and watch daytime TV. And the opportunity came to a volunteer here at the library and basically kind of start from scratch and sort out all of the documents and the photos and the files that had been saved here, but had not really been coordinated or put in any kind of a cohesive effort, I guess. So from that, the more that I searched and the more I discovered, the more that I became convinced this stuff needed to be on display. And thankfully, with the support and the encouragement of our director, Carl Walworth, and the support of the board, I basically have created what we call the Mattoon History Center, which is now encompasses almost all of the basement. And our latest exhibit is the entire hallway in what's the lower basement. And so we just have documented and created storyboards on everything to do with the history of Mattoon going all the way back to 1855 and Mattoon's founding. And so it's become more than just a project. It's become a passion. I'm here every day. I just enjoy every day of it.
Well, I can see why. I mean, it's one of the most thorough museums that I have been in and has so much information packed into it that there's just no way a person can go there and see everything in one day. That it's a multi-visit operation. There's so much to see. And then you have your Civil War room.
Well, it's taken me 5 years to put it all together, so you can't see it in one day.
I'm sure that's true. Yeah. I mean, and all the details that you have, and like all the restaurants that have been in Mattoon, and all the car dealerships, and all the businesses, and the way you have it broken down is just really fascinating. And I've lived in Mattoon all my life, and there's not a time I could go in there and not learn more than I thought I already knew. You know, it's just, it's astonishing to me.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate that. And of course, you know, that's one of the goals to me when I started this. I didn't really have a master plan. Everything's just kind of come together one section at a time. But, you know, my goal has always been to document and do a compendium of the things that I think are important to people that do come down here, businesses, industries, events, institutions. But, you know, my primary focus has been to preserve, you know, Mattoon's rich history. And every time I think about doing another project, you know, my kind of my thought process is, you know, when I'm long gone, 25 years from now, is this going to be something that somebody's going to be interested in and want to know more about? And that's kind of what drives me to continue to dig and continue to fill in the blanks, if you will.
Yeah, I think those of us who are on the page like the Good Old Days in Mattoon, Illinois Facebook page, it is abundantly clear that people are eager for that history. Number one, they're eager for that history. And number two, our memories are very faulty when it comes to what we remember as history in this town. And I'm sure that's true for any town, but the arguments that get settled there, and you're generally the ultimate decision maker in those arguments, but people can say it was in this block, it was on that block, it was on the north side, the south side, and our memories, I don't know why it is, our memories get flawed like that.
Well, that is. And I mean, it's kind of interesting over the years as I do follow that. In fact, it's kind of fun that there's a lot of people think that I'm the administrator on the good old days. And I am not. I'm just a contributor, but I have a really good long distance relationship with the administrator. I do, you know, follow that on a daily basis and try and add context and share photos. But the one advantage I have, and I've said this many, many times, is I have access to everything in here. So I can, you know, when there is a dispute or I won't say maybe a dispute, but when there is a misremembrance, I have the advantage of being able to go pull out the file or pull out a picture or, you know, kind of be the last word on things. And I still learn things all the time, too. In fact, you know, just a couple of days ago, there was something came up and the person that put it up was very adamant about it. And I just said, I have never seen any documentation to prove that. If you can, you know, enlighten me, I would be happy to have that information. And of course, that conversation went nowhere because it was something that they just, you know. I always say whenever a comment on the good old days starts with, I heard, somebody said, or I was told, I just ignore it because somebody said is not a valid argument.
Yeah, that seems to be a problem throughout the internet today.
Right. Even
not necessarily related to history. So the project that I knew you were had most recently worked on, and as you said, the big dig in the hallway. How did you acquire those photos that you have in that hallway? Those amazing photos.
Well, the bulk, a lot of the photos we already had, and that all comes back to, you know, what I said all along is we have some amazing photo archives here, and I over the years I've digitized all those, and I use several of them in some of the other storyboards. But about a year and a half ago, I had the opportunity through somebody that had acquired, I think at an auction, 78 inch by 10 inch glass plate negatives. And of course, some of you may, you know, some people may know the glass, that was the old original ways of preserving film instead of the celluloid negatives that they use now before digital cameras. And he had 8x10, he had 70 of these, and they were 8x10 full format size, and they were taken by the Illinois Central photographers at the time of the project, what we call the Big Dig. And he wanted a substantial amount of money for them, and frankly, more than they probably were worth, except for the fact that, you know, the price is dependent on who wants them and how much they're willing to pay. And with knowing that they were there and knowing what the value of them was to the Mattoon history, we determined, I talked to our director, and we decided that, you know, they were worth pursuing. So we have a lot, we have several very generous patrons that have supported the library and in particular have supported the History Center down here. Because it was, like I said, it was a substantial amount of money, and it was enough that we couldn't justify using library funds to buy them. So we reached out to several of our, like I said, very generous patrons, and raised the money privately to buy these negatives. And after we got them in our possession, I scanned them all at 600 DPI, which is a pretty good resolution. And the resolution on these things for being 110 years old is just phenomenal. And many of them are photos that have never been seen before and had never been published. So that was really the cornerstone of creating this, what I consider a major permanent exhibit. And the library board was generous enough to acquiesce and let me have the walls of the lower basement hallway to do this exhibit. So that was the genesis of it. And then as we got the exhibit done and up, quite a few visitors, the first thing they'd say is, you ought to put this into a book. So that's how the book came to be.
Oh, boy. We're going to get into the book a little bit later. I'm so excited for you about that. That is just an amazing project. But could you explain to people, and I grew up in Mattoon and lived here all my life, and there was always what we called the subway, the bridge, there by the railroad station on Broadway, and then the other bridges across the railroad tracks. But most of us, I mean, I wasn't even really aware of that. Was just something that was there. I just assumed it was always there. I didn't know why. I knew Mattoon was a railroad town with a great history of railroads. But would you explain the history of what caused this big dig to come about?
Sure. Well, and your remembrance is not uncommon. I mean, and again, that was part of the reason that I wanted to do the exhibit in addition to, displaying the photos, because people would come down here all the time. And when I would mention about that it was dug out, created the subway, I mean, people were just surprised and, just took for granted that those lowered tracks that go all the way through Mattoon had always been there. So what the backstory is of that, of course, most people realize Mattoon was founded when the two railroads crossed here in Mattoon in 1855. The Illinois Central was going north and south, and what became known, and I'll refer to it as the Big Four, because that's what it was during the time of the Big Dig. It eventually became part of the New York Central system. But the two railroads crossed at what's called grade level. In other words, the tracks crossed just like today we cross a railroad track on a street. And from almost the beginning, that was problematic because the Illinois Central trains had to yield the right-of-way to the Big Four trains because the Big Four was there first and owned the right of way. So the Illinois Central trains had to yield to them. And as time went on, it became very problematic for many reasons. One, of course, was the delay. The Illinois Central trains experienced major delays. And of course, in the railroad, every railroad is supposed to run on time, and time is money. So as the Illinois Central trains got backed up and had to wait, then that cost them money. There were also several accidents along the way, and kind of the defining accident and really what was the catalyst to this whole project was on September 29th in 1911, an Illinois Central train was basically trying to beat a Big Four train to the crossing, and they collided, and the Big Four train, the locomotive, was overturned, and the engineer was crushed to death, was killed.
Oh, my God.
And so at that time, the Illinois Railroad Commission stepped in and said, y'all got to do something about this crossing. It's too dangerous. There's too many accidents. That was what was really the genesis of getting the project started. One of the options was to put in a blocking tower so that the Illinois Central trains could not proceed when New York Central Big Four trains were on the track. That in itself was going to be a very expensive proposition and would create a lot of other problems. So the Illinois Central decided, instead of putting in a blocking tower, that they would undertake a project to lower the tracks. So the official title for this project was the Illinois Central Railroad Track Depression Project, because they depressed the tracks. So that was how the whole project came to be. And by the time they had to acquire the right-of-way, they had to get the rights to a lot of the property. They had to, of course, raise the funds. So the project was pretty much decided in that 1911 time frame, but it took until late 1913, early 1914 to really get the project started and get it underway. And of course, what we've all come to realize today is, you know, what that project did is it basically changed the landscape of Mattoon, Illinois forever, mm-hmm. because we created a canyon that went right through basically at that time what was the center of the city. And it is in averages about 27 feet deep, and in different places, depending on how the tracks are running, anywhere from 50 to almost 100 feet wide. So, of course, when you mm-hmm. When you make a 27-foot trench through the heart of the city, somehow you've got to get across that trench. So part of the project was building the bridges that we still have today. Now, they've all been updated. They're not the same bridge, but they're not the same physical structure, but they're in the mm-hmm. same physical location. And in many cases, the pilings and the superstructure is the same as what was put in back in 1915. So, and it created a myriad of other problems, of other issues that needed to be addressed. You had to move power lines, you had to move sewer lines, you had to move water lines. All that was part of the project, and that's a lot of what we cover in the story in the book.
Wow.
But then the most significant thing that is still prevalent today is we have the Illinois Central Railroad Depot on Broadway, which is still used today by Amtrak. Well, because of the Depression, the tracks were moved, and so both railroads had to build new passenger terminals. So that was also part of the whole project.
Oh my gosh.
So that kind of in a nutshell was the overall project.
I never even thought about, you know, you talk about acquiring land rights and everything. This is something I didn't ask a question about because I wasn't even aware of it, but were there buildings there, businesses there that had to be relocated or taken? I never even considered that.
Quite a few of them.
Wow,
actually,
really?
Yeah. You know, lumber yards, dry cleaners, freight terminals, broomcorn warehouses. I mean, dozens and dozens of buildings, everything from, you know, small storefronts to major warehouse buildings were either demolished or had to have their foundations shored up or in most cases moved. And that was all, again, part of the whole process. Just acquiring all the property took about a year.
Oh, wow. So were there people? I know I can't wait. Now I'm even more excited to see you read your book. I can't wait to see all this because were there people that were maybe unwilling? Was this kind of a case of eminent domain where they had to?
Yeah, there were several cases of eminent domain. Primarily, most of the businesses acquiesced because they knew in the long run it was going to be better for their business. I don't know that there was that much pushback from the businesses and the railroad pretty well. I mean, you know, they paid a good price to acquire the properties. Most of the pushback came from residential owners. And the biggest group of those was, if people may know today, where the old Illinois Central Freight Warehouse is on Lakeland Boulevard. Of course, back in those days, it was South 18th Street. Well, that was built as part of the project, and that building is still here today. But the railroad had to acquire almost a full city block to relocate their freight warehouse and the attendant rail sidings that went with it. And several of those property owners went to court and tried to, mainly not so much to hold onto their property, but to get a higher price than what the railroad offered. So there was some contention there, yes.
Oh, wow. I never, and was that where, you said the one is still standing. I know where that is, but where was Holman's? Was Holman's closer to Charleston Avenue, the Holman building?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Holman was already there, and Holman did not have to move. Holman's was up on Charleston Avenue at 19th Street.
Okay,
So they were still there, but they expanded after that. Where the Illinois Central Freight Warehouse is, you may remember until just recently, Lakeland Florals was in that building.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's the red brick building on between Lafayette and Marshall on South Lakeland.
Wow, 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 wow. That's just so exciting. I'm getting goosebumps talking about this. This is just, I never didn't know I was going to get so excited about learning about this. So, Chris, this all happened in 1914. What was the population of Mattoon at that time? Do you know?
Mattoon was really a thriving small city, again, primarily because of the two railroads, of about 14,000 people.
Wow, that's incredible. So we've only grown about 5,000 people in, not even that many. I think we went forward and then we've kind of dropped back a little bit in population.
We went forward and then we dropped back. Yeah.
Yeah,
hopefully we don't go all the way back.
I was going to say, that would be kind of sad. Yeah. So, Chris, where did this money come from to make that happen? Where did the money come from?
Well, that's very interesting. The Illinois Central Railroad paid for the whole darn thing.
Really?
Yeah, because it was their project. Now, the Big Four Railroad probably paid about 10% of it because they, in the overall cost, because they had to upgrade some of their trackage and stuff, and that fell on them. But all of the cost of the dig itself, the contractors, the bridges, and all that fell to the railroad. Now, some of the and a few things, there were some compromises made. The city, because there was a city waterworks and city sewer, although back in those days, even most residences in the city limits still had outhouses or septics. There wasn't a widespread city sewer, but there were storm sewers. And so there were some compromises made because the railroad had to put in a huge network of storm sewers down in that ditch to move away all the water that would otherwise be standing. So as kind of a trade-off, the city had to reroute some of their utilities, but as a trade-off, the railroad agreed to allow the city to dump everything into the storm sewers that the railroad constructed and built. Wow. So that was one of the trade-offs that they did in order to make the project happen.
But then all the bridges and everything, all the construction of all that and the changing of the streets, that part all fell to the city itself, right, to pay for that?
Oh, no. The railroad built all the bridges.
Really?
The railroad was a response. Yeah, because, I mean, the railroad created the problem. So the railroad was responsible for the bridges, but the city was responsible for the approach right up to the bridge. So they coordinated all that.
That's amazing to me. It's amazing to me on so many levels, because seeing the way things work in cities today, and Mattoon is no different than any other town, trying to get things done and trying to compromise and working out all, you know, the logistics of making something happen. But to think about it happening in those days when things were a lot more different than they are now, and then to be able to work together and make it happen and bring it, and also to have a company pay for all of it, to me, that's another thing that's pretty incredible. Did I hear you right in the beginning that the Illinois Central had to yield to the Big Four? Was that correct?
Yes.
So that's why they were willing to pay for this. That in itself to me is mind blowing.
Well, when the railroads crossed here at Mattoon in 1855, what became the Big Four got here first by one day. And they really pushed to get here first, because they knew even back then in railroad law, whichever road crosses an existing road, the crossing road is responsible for all the maintenance and also has to yield the right of way. So by the Big Four getting here a day ahead, that always put the Illinois Central in the secondary position. And what made that even more critical for the Illinois Central is because, if any of you, I'm sure you've never been by where House Brothers Tavern is, but if you ever go down Broadway and look over behind where the House Brothers and De Beers, there's that big wide parking lot there.
Yeah.
And you may wonder, why is that parking lot so large right there? Well, until the Big Four, before the New York Central pulled the tracks out in 1983, those were all switch tracks there. There were several sets of switching tracks back there behind all those businesses on Western. So as the Big Four was switching cars, they had the Illinois Central tracks blocked. So that added to the situation of having the tracks blocked. And then the other thing that really came into play for the Illinois Central, as the trains got bigger and heavier and the loads got heavier, and they were hauling, they called it a coal train was called a coal drag. They were starting to bring 100 car coal drags up from Southern Illinois up to the Chicagoland area loaded with coal. Well, when the Illinois Central trains had to stop and yield to the Big Four trains, they would have to back all the way back down past Marshall to get enough momentum to get up, to get back up, because Mattoon, right where the tracks were, sits on a ridge. So it not only caused Illinois Central the delay, but it caused them a lot of operating expense to be able to keep the momentum going. And that's exactly why the accident happened in 1911, because the engineer on the Illinois Central train didn't want to have to stop and then back all the way back down south of Marshall to get his momentum to get back up the grade. So he decided to just try and beat the Big Four train. So there were a lot. I mean, and that's what's really fun about digging into this. And what I really found as I dug deeper and deeper, it was not just one single little issue. It was a bunch of things. And then on top of that, you asked me about 1914. People will be surprised, I think, to learn that in 1914, Mattoon had 8 new car dealerships, and they were selling 14 different brands of automobiles. So you all of a sudden had a much increased automobile traffic on the city streets. And so the people that were all getting blocked by the Illinois Central, having all the north, south, east, west streets blocked, people were complaining to City Hall, to the commissioners, to the mayor, you've got to get these, do something about these trains because we can't get across town. So, I mean, it was just, it was a cascade of events that caused all this to happen. And we tell all that in the book.
Yeah, I'm just so excited. I never dreamed that you'd uncovered all this information. You've done your own big dig about the big dig, haven't you?
I like that.
Well, I'm amazed. I mean, I'm just amazed. So were there, just to step out of this for 1 second, were there any other comparable projects like this done in any other towns in Illinois or around the nation? Or
yeah, but I can't speak for the nation because I haven't, you know, gone out that far. But this was the first major project like this in Illinois, taken on by the Illinois Central. And it turned out to be such a success for them. They did the same type of project in Monee, Illinois, up by Chicago in 1922. So, you know, what, 8 years later? Mm-hmm. And then subsequently in 1923, they did the same project in Paxton. And when I was doing all this research, just for the fun, I didn't really want to drive to Monee, but I did. We took a day trip and went up to Paxton. I just wanted to kind of see the lay of the land. And actually, they have a pretty nice little railroad museum in the old freight station in Paxton. And I mean, it's almost deja vu. You get out of your car and you stand up and you look, and it looks just, I mean, you feel like you're in Mattoon. I mean, they did the exact same project and cut the city of Paxton in half to do the same thing, because they had an interference up there. And I'm embarrassed right now because I can't tell you what the other railroad was up there. It was not the Big Four. It, you know, it might have been the pencil. I don't know what it was, but they had the same right-of-way issue in Paxton. So they did the project there. So Mattoon was really the template for 2 other projects that occurred several years later.
And when I look at this, the scope and the size of those machines that were brought in, I know there are more than one, I suppose, but the massive size of the undertaking of all that, it's mind-blowing, isn't it?
It really is, and I refer to them all through the book as giant steam shovel, because they were giant machines. And one reason for that is, you know, we're still in the early, you know, 1914. I mean, hydraulics had not come in. I mean, nowadays, if you go out and look at, you know, at a big entrenching tool or a track hoe or anything, I mean, hydraulics rules, that's what operates. I mean, farm equipment, it's all hydraulic. But hydraulics had not really come into time yet. So the steam shovels, they actually, I mean, they were really basically a steam locomotive with a shovel on the front end, because each one of these steam shovels had its own, you know, steam engine. And there was a guy on there shoveling coal into the steam engine, and it ran on the rails. And then the dig itself, the shovel, the dipper, was operated by chains and pulleys. And so it was very rudimentary in today, but for 1914, it was state of the art. And the other thing I point out, you know, throughout the book is, I say it was the intersection of men with picks and shovels and steam shovels, because they had a workforce of hundreds and hundreds of men, and a lot of the work, a lot of the detail work was still done by men with picks, shovels, and wheelbarrows, and a lot of the final grading was done with men with scrapers pulled by horses and mules. So, I mean, it was it kind of covered the whole spectrum.
And as I said earlier, you know, as somebody that was, that's always been there. It's just an assumption. I never even gave it a thought until all this came up, you know, and it all came up because of the History Center, because of the work that you did to bring right. that to people's attention. And that's one of the things that I find so fascinating about what you do. And I wish I could have a time machine and go back to that time when those things happened, for several reasons. I know life was a lot more difficult in a lot of ways, like having to use an outhouse, but it was a lot nicer in a lot of ways that people were a little more civil to one another than they are now. I think I'd almost sacrifice a certain creature comfort to have civility.
I agree with you in some regards, but by the same token, in all the research that I've done on other projects, if you go back and read the newspapers, especially before the turn of the century, the vitriol today is nothing compared to the vitriol back in those days. The newspapers would thought nothing of slandering somebody, doing caricatures of people. I mean, I don't think things have really changed all that much. I don't want to argue with you too much about that, but it's kind of interesting to see. And we'll go back for just a moment. I'll talk a little for just a minute about, you know, our Civil War Center. And when I did all that research, one of the things I found out was, you know, the newspaper in Charleston at that time, and I'm not picking on our friends in Charleston, but the newspaper in Charleston was heavily pro-Southern. And the headlines back and forth between the Mattoon newspaper and the Charleston newspaper, it's a wonder that the two editors didn't go out on the street and have a duel. I mean, it was just plain nasty. So kind of a little perspective there.
Well, you know what? When you said that, it makes me think when we went to visit the Abraham Lincoln Museum in Springfield, seeing some right. of the things that were written back during that time were shocking to me. So I have to agree with you on that. And thanks for reminding me of that, because you're right that it's not always been as civil as I'd like to think. I guess that's one of those things of wanting it to be different than it actually was. So, and the expense, right. that project, the Big Dig, if I'm not mistaken, didn't it cost $1 million back then?
Yes, and $1 million back then. And in fact, in the book I list, in kind of the introduction I list, because people call it the Big Dig, people call it the Big Ditch, people call it the Subway. It was called the $1 million Dig. I mean, so I kind of use those names interchangeably through the book just to kind of keep all the different terms refreshed. But yes, the Illinois Central committed to spend $1 million in 1914 to do the project. And that comes out to about $32, $34 million today.
Yeah, that's what I was going to get at. That is, and I know that back then that's an incredible amount of money. But to try to think of accomplishing something like that, and that would take a lot of GoFundMe pages and a lot of bake sales to make that happen if people are going to try to make it happen in today's world.
Right, right. Well, you know, in perspective, 1914, $1 million, a loaf of bread was a nickel, and a 6.5 ounce Coca-Cola was a nickel out of the machine at the grain elevator. So there you go.
Oh, what a different world. My mother grew up at 3120 Marion, and she was born in 1920. And she used to talk about walking uptown all the time. And you know, I try to picture what things were like. What would it be like to get to downtown? And what were things like in downtown Mattoon? And then from 3120 Marion, when there weren't probably paved sidewalks and all the things that, you know, how different it would have been in that time frame. So, Chris, when did you start doing the book? What was the defining point that said, I got to do that?
Well, like I said, we put the project together, the exhibit down in the lower basement. We launched that last year in late August, probably, because as you know, I leave every year for the month of September. And so we had that exhibit opened just right before I left. So that was, you know, a year ago, September. And it had taken me, you know, probably 6 months to put everything together to create that exhibit. And that's not working. You know, I'm here every day. I get inquiries. You know, I horse around on the good old days. people come down. So I work on things just in spurts. So it probably took me about 6 months to put that project together, design all the boards, get everything done. And in doing all that, of course, I started doing all that research. And then as I when probably the first of the year, maybe a little bit before the first of the year is when we kind of determined, hey, this could make a book. And then I took all my research and then I had to really expand it, because where I had the story about, you know, taking over that eminent domain for those buildings, I wanted to know what that entailed, how many buildings it was, who the people were. So I went into a lot deeper, and my file folders went from about 3 inches thick to about 2 feet thick. And then that's when I started putting all that information together and compiling what the book. And then when you see the book, you know, of course, it's broken down in chapters. And so as I was doing it, and I'd never, you know, I'm not formally trained to write a book. So my chapters, each chapter started out as what I called an essay. So I would put together an essay of that particular subject and include all the information, and then just took everything and started merging it together. So putting the book together itself and doing the format and the layout and the size took about 6 full months. And then we did, and of course, we tell a lot of the story, but, you know, the highlight of the book really is the photos. I mean, the book is a 9-inch by 12-inch hardcover, what we call a coffee table book. And it includes 170 photos in addition to all of the text. But the photos are really the meat and potatoes of the book. One reason of that, and one reason of the size, is because all those 8x10 negatives we had, we wanted to reproduce those at full size. So most of the photos are a full page just of themselves, of the photo and then a caption. So, and then the attendant text follows each set of photos in each series. So you can see the flow of the project from the wreck all the way through to the last part of the project, you know, which wound up really a couple of years later to get everything done.
You know, I don't know that I'd ever heard about that wreck until today. Have you told that story before about why?
I hadn't told the story, and I wasn't aware of it until I did the deeper dig.
The big dig on the big dig. Wow. Yeah. I was going to say, I didn't remember ever hearing that. Because we always hear so much about the interurban accident that had happened between here and Charleston.
Right.
But I had never heard that. Wow. This book is going to be so exciting for so many people. I can't wait.
I hope people find it interesting. I mean, our target audience is people in Mattoon, and maybe not just people that live in Mattoon, but, you know, there are people from Mattoon all over the United States. So we hope we do some mail order business. But the other thing that's significant is I hope that this appeals to some of the railroad fans, because, you know, rail buffs, they come out of the woodwork when you start talking about trains And so I think, you know, there's at least several rail fan pages on Facebook that I follow. And so we're going to post the information about the book there. So I hope that we get as much interest from railroad people as we do from you know, local people themselves.
Oh, I'm sure you will. It's just such an exciting project, and I'm so happy for you. You know, you deserve so many pats on the back. You've just done this so selflessly, and you've not done it for any accolades, but you certainly deserve a lot of accolades. I know you're very self-deprecating kind of a guy, but...
Well, thank you for that. So if I can do a little plug, and you mentioned earlier, the unveiling of the book is going to be October 22nd from 4 to 7 at Casey Summers Toyota dealership. Keith, as many people know, has done so much for Mattoon, and he just very graciously just jumped on the bandwagon right away and said, let me host the rollout of the book. So it will be available for purchase then. And of course, I'll be happy to sign books if people buy them that evening. And then we haven't done it yet because we wanted to wait until the official rollout. But after that evening, there will be a link on the library Facebook page and the library website to be able to order the books mail order. And they're not going to be on Amazon because this is a limited run, and Amazon really, you know, they take their share. and the whole impetus for this, in addition to telling the story, of course, is from the day one, I envision this as being a fundraiser for the library. So I am not, I'm not making any money on this book. All of the proceeds are going to the library. So, and of course, we've done it on the auspices of the library, and the library is the one that has, you know, done the upfront cost. So, I want people to, you know, I'm shamelessly plugging the book, but I'm not plugging it for my own personal edification. I'm not going to make a penny off of this, and nor did I want to.
Yeah, you're not that guy. You've always been a person to promote the town, and not for any glory of your own. You know, that's just not who you are.
Well, thank you.
That's why we love you.
It's become a passion, and I mean, I'm really invested in this community, and this is my way to give back something to Mattoon.
Not just that. I know that also when you're, you know, when you've had heartache in your life, sometimes you can pour yourself into your work, and that gives you fuel to keep going sometimes past some of the aches that we've had to deal with. So, and I know you're no stranger to those heartaches in your life. So, not, you know, you don't dig into a bottle of whiskey. You dig into the bottom of the big dig. So.
There you go.
Well, I'm so happy for you, Chris. I'm happy for myself. I can't wait to get a copy of your book. That's going to be so exciting. And so would you give the contact information of the website when the book is available? And again, give those dates of or any other contact information you have for the History Center, too?
Right. Yeah. So the date for the rollout of the book will be October 22nd, which is 2 weeks from yesterday, and it'll be from 4 to 7. It's just an open house and a book signing at the Casey Summers Toyota dealership. We've got everything on the back end in place, but we have not set it up yet because we want to wait until after the rollout. But there will be a link on the Mattoon Public Library website, and there will be a link on the Mattoon Public Library Facebook page. Okay. So on either one of those, you'll be able to go and click the link, and it'll take you to the order form in order to order the book. And hopefully we've got the Friends of the Library volunteers on standby to hopefully pack and ship a bunch of books. And they'll also be available for anybody to walk in and purchase one across the counter at the library. They'll be here, you know, the stock of them will be in the library.
And what a wonderful Christmas present for people who have friends and family who live away from here, not just people that live here in town. It's a wonderful gift for them too, but what a great one-of-a-kind Christmas present.
Yep. Well, that's one reason we kind of targeted, you know, hitting this date, because we thought it would be something that would be of interest to people, especially people that live out of town.
Yeah. Do you know the web address of the Mattoon Public Library? Is it mattoonlibrary.org? Or?
I think it's, you know, that you got me flat-footed here, but I think it's just, it's mattoonlibrary.org.
Yeah, I believe so. So that's, I just want people to have every opportunity to be exposed and get this book. Chris, you know, it's been wonderful talking to you. We had a little trouble getting started, but now we're going to have trouble getting stopped. I just always enjoy visiting
with
you so much.
I do too. I really enjoy
it. I learned so much from you.
Well, and like I've told you before, you're a great interviewer. I always look forward to you always have good questions and good insight. So I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I've been watching Dan Rather. And Barbara Walters. No, I'm just kidding. I wish, but no. I do enjoy dying.
Yeah.
It's been a load of fun. I thank you for taking your time to be here. I know you're a busy guy, but we love you, and thank you. I want to thank you again for being here, Chris.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, thanks very much. And I'll look forward to some feedback from the podcast.
All righty. I think we'll call this to a close then. This is the end of this episode of Life on the Illinois Prairie, and please be kind. Thanks for listening to Life on the Illinois Prairie, the undercurrents of our American life. If you haven't yet, go ahead and subscribe to Life on the Illinois Prairie wherever you get your podcast. Stay tuned for more stories, interviews, and updates. I'm your host, Wendy Fleming Dexter. Until next time.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.